King's Park is Perth's great botanical garden, overlooking the city on a wonderful prominence, high above, and doing research even with industry. Here's Dr. Carol Elliott.
So for the species I've been working on, it's mainly with the mining industry that we've got partnerships with, and it's a fairly well-rounded kind of partnership. The mining industry approaches us with certain questions that they need answering, and we provide them with the support and the research that is needed to answer those questions for them.
What questions are they asking about being lighter on the land, perhaps?
Yes. Lighter on the land and being able to amend or ameliorate some of the disturbances that they have on the land themselves. So in my particular case with the rare species, they've had some indirect and direct impacts on the population, and they've been asked to return the species to the landscape, and working out how to return that species is where we come in. We help them with that.
Reminds me a tiny bit of Harry Butler's work years ago, you know, because he was working in tandem. Do you find them receptive to get on with, or are they very defensive, or what?
Certain components, perhaps, of the mining industry can be a little bit hard to get to know, but my experience with the mining industry has been absolutely wonderful. They're there to help, they're there to make progress, and they're there to make sure that the environment that they've utilised is returned to the state as best they can.
As best they can. If they blow something up, you tell them off.
I don't tell them off. Someone else does.
Yes, well, Dr. Carol Elliott is a research scientist at King's Park, working on rare plants, as we'll hear shortly. Patrick Courtney looks after the horticultural development there, but more immediately he's been trying to save trees that have been dying all over the gardens. Patrick, what are we looking at here?
We're looking at a Mary that is a tree that's been saved here at King's Park in our urban forest. And it's a great example of an exciting project where scientists, horticulturalists, arborists and volunteers have worked together to combat a major threat.
Okay, you say King's Park, which of course is quite famous if you visit Perth, but it's your botanic gardens, isn't it?
It is our state botanic gardens, and it's one of the major urban parks in the world. And we're renowned for our plant science, but also for our botanic gardens.
And why were you worried about this tree? What was happening to it?
Well, it wasn't just this tree is the problem. Back in the late 1990s, we changed a process for our water treatment, and inadvertently that has changed pH in the park. And so a syndrome has occurred where thousands of trees are being affected with what we call chlorotic decline syndrome.
Too much alkaline, really?
Yeah. The bore water has become alkaline and we are losing trace elements from the system. And the resulting chlorosis is slowly causing loss of canopy and finally limb drop and then death. And this is a critical thing for a place like King's Park, that we can reverse that process.
You've got various horror pictures I've been looking at, how the tree was denuded and you're losing its leaves and then standing there almost skeletal. And then your treatment gradually brought it back. And I'm looking really at a great big thriving tree now. It's quite tall. It's got lots of branches and the leaves are nice and lime green. It's doing well.
You'd have to say it's one of the healthiest trees here now. And what we did here was a localised experiment where we changed pH locally. And that tree, within 6 weeks, started to grow a new canopy. And within 6 months, it grew a whole new canopy. And Marys are very plastic entities and they tend to respond in this way. So this hasn't just come about recently. We've had studies done through our plant science at King's Park back in around 2005, and they identified this phenomenon being related to trace or micro elements, and manganese is the main issue here. And what we're doing in this small trial was actually working out, could we get a landscape scale solution?
And so are you confident that you've got the whole system, the whole park really, with all these many trees which are threatened, back into health?
Well, currently chlorotic decline is here and present, but later this year we're actually going to change our primary water source and we're going to adjust pH. So the problem occurred because the water source became more alkaline, and now we're going to acid dose with nearly pure sulfuric acid, and we're going to adjust that small adjustment down, and we are going to eradicate CDS at a landscape scale.
Had other botanic gardens experienced this at all?
This is a widespread phenomenon, not only in places like botanic gardens, but nationally, overseas, in America, in Europe, and it happens anywhere where we start using alkaline water to irrigate parklands or agriculture.
Patrick, tell me the story of your boab.
Well, that's another fascinating story. Back in 2008, I was contacted by some contractors working on the Great Northern Highway, and a guy called Jamie Shaw said, "Pat, we want to move a boab about 50 metres. And I said, "Yeah, that should be possible." But I said, "Would you like to move it a bit further?" And he said, "How far?" And I said, "Well, maybe about 3,000 kilometres south." And from there, a whole group of people worked a community project up to see if we could move a very large boab 3,000 kilometres from the East Kimberley to Perth.
And was it a world record?
It was a world record. The tree turned out to weigh about 37 tonnes, and it was this magnificent gift from the Gidja people of the East Kimberley. And that distance by land of a tree of that size had never been done before.
Describe it. It's got this huge trunk, hasn't it?
It has. The girth is maybe 3 to 3.5 metres across, and it's got the classic boab shape with bifurcated stems, and it's one of the great trees of the world. And everywhere where people see boabs, whether they're our Australian species or the African and Madagascan ones, they fascinate humans. And it was a great thing to get here in the park so visitors just to the southern areas could come and see some of the glory of the north. And we've got great northern displays of plants.
And when you brought it here, how did you look after it and make it thrive again?
Look, we're so lucky here at King's Park. We have the greatest horticulturalists. In fact, everyone here is a great person, and people looked at the very best ways we could establish this plant. So we've done all sorts of things. We put in coarse soils for drainage, and we've reversed the seasons. So we exclude water in winter and we add water in summer to mimic the north where they get northern rainfall.
Congratulations, well done. How long have you been at the King's Park?
Oh, about 27 years now. A long time, but it's a great place to work, and it never ceases to amaze me. Even now, I still walk at lunchtime through the park looking at new things.
Patrick Courtney, and yes, botanic gardens such as King's Park offer unlimited treasures for the observant. And so back to Carol Elliott and her rare plants. She provides a reminder to our story last week with Professor Stephen Hopper at the University of Western Australia how those vast and varied patches of plants buffered by stable weather are now so very vulnerable to change and to us. Working on rare plants, what's your definition of a rare plant? One you haven't found yet?
No, a rare plant is something you pretty much don't see anywhere else. So a lot of the species I work on, they occur in very, very small areas in the landscape, and they pretty much only occur here and nowhere else.
And especially presumably in the biodiversity hotspot, which is, you know, from Perth down in the southwest.
Yes, that's right. We do have a lot of those. I know that there's over 400 of these kinds of species in the state, and then there's a list of about 3,000 more of which we know very, very little about that are very important to know.
How come Perth and Western Australia are so blessed? Is it the fact that the soils are unbelievably old? But I would have thought they're old everywhere around Australia.
Yes, the soils in WA are very old. Our landscape is highly eroded and weathered, and this creates long, stable terms where these plants can evolve and grow and speciate amongst each other. So a lot of the terrain that I work on, these isolated banded ironstone ranges, they have their own suite of rare and threatened species. And even though you might find the same genera on each of these particular ranges, they're all different species. So no one species occurs across multiple ranges for a lot of the species that I work on.
Speciation, in other words, you get them adapted to their own area and you get a huge variety of plants across the landscape.
Yes, a lot of variety, a lot of different ways that these plants are able to adapt and cope with the area that they're in.
Is there one that you're particularly... Gosh, those birds you've got are very... They want to be on radio as well, don't they?
Yeah, they want to be heard. They want to be heard.
You've got a good population. But is there one you're concentrating on?
Yes, so currently I'm working on a threatened species called Tetratheca, which Latin for four boxes. and that's relating to the box shape of the anthers of the flower. So this is a unique species in itself because it's buzz pollinated. So those boxed anthers require an insect to buzz pollinate them, which is vibrate their wings enough to release the pollen so that the insect can gather it up and take it away to make honey. This particular species occurs on banded ironstone formations out in the Goldfields region, so its rainfall is 300 mils or less, so very arid environment on a rocky terrain makes for pretty harsh conditions for the plant to live in. And part of the research that I'm involved in is working out ways we can get this plant species back into the environment, because the plant species occurs within some mining leases, and the conditions for which the mining companies can either directly or indirectly impact these species requires mitigation actions. And there's a lot of research involved in working out what those sorts of actions can be and how they might actually work.
If I had this plant in front of me, what would it look like?
You might describe it as a unassuming, nondescript plant. I think it's quite pretty. When it's flowering, it's very pretty, but it's a small leafless shrub, so you really just see green stems above the ground. But its flowers can range from white to like a soft pink or soft purple. They're quite pretty.
Quite pretty if you look close. Now, this reminds me of Kingsley Dixon and paper he published and got lots of press, where he was saying that it's the pretty plants that the botanists look at most. And the other ones, which are quite sweet, as you describe, but not flashy, they get neglected. But you are making the balance, aren't you?
Yes. So I guess only in September one might call these plants pretty. The rest of the year you might ignore them or think they're a tuft of biomass out of a rock that has no importance. Yes, I guess I'm balancing it out in terms of looking at something that perhaps not everyone would think is immediately pretty to the eye.
And why is this important? You've got 400 rare specimens, and who knows how many more there are in this vast landscape. Why is it important to know about them?
It's important to know about these species because they actually form a fairly key component of the landscape and the ecosystems in which they occur. So the Tetrathecus, for example, even though each species perhaps occurs on an individual range, they do fulfill a service for the pollinators, and they also provide food for ants as well. So the ants will collect these seeds up and just disperse it across the cliff faces, consume the food body that's attached to the seed, and then the seeds themselves will grow out from those cracks where the ants have taken them into. So these plants do provide kind of a service to the insect community.
And is there anything, by the way, that makes them trigger the buzzing in the insects? Do they tickle them or something?
No, I suspect that the pollinators are attracted to the flower colour initially, and then the insects themselves, my understanding is that their mechanism is that they disengage some of the muscles that control their flight in their wings. And when those muscles disengage, they can vibrate the wings at a frequency that allows the pollen to be released from the anthers themselves, and then they collect it up.
Isn't nature wonderful?
Nature is really, really wonderful. It's fascinating, and I think we have a lot to learn from what it does and how it can survive where it does.
Dr. Carol Elliott in charge of rare plants at King's Park. And this is the Gorgeous Science Show on RN. We're about, later on, to hear about magpies and love. But right now, that promised news on a blue kangaroo paw, a flower, that is. Meet Digby Grounds, senior plant breeder.
I'd like to talk to you about the development of our flora for home gardens and landscapes and why we're doing that. We're the only ornamental program that's on environmental basis.
And your blue kangaroo paws, what's that about?
Well, we've been breeding kangaroo paws since about 2007, and the aim was to really produce varieties that are a lot more disease tolerant, that lasted longer in your garden, particularly the small ones, which generally have a drop-dead syndrome. So we did a range of breeding with them. And then serendipitously in 2012, one came through that had bluish tones to it, which was something I'd never seen before. So then I targeted that particular variety. And now, later this year, for the first time, we'll be releasing a number of blue-flowered kangaroo paws. Very exciting.
It really is a wonderful blue colour, I must say, and it's not in any way artificial, is it?
No, not in any way. Produced by traditional hybridisation, so there's been no gene technology or anything like that used.
I don't mind gene technology.
I don't either in the right purposes, but we haven't needed to use it in this instance. So it really came from combining a green flowered and a purple flowered mutation of our red and green kangaroo paw, and then the resultant hybrid several generations later just expressed these blue colours.
What's the drop dead syndrome?
Oh, the drop dead syndrome is famous, particularly for West Australian flora. And because our flora is from such an ancient landscape, it's really well adapted to just being where it is. So when you bring that into cultivation and you change the water regime, the soil type, pest and disease management, often they don't respond very well. And so they just turn up their toes and drop dead. And so that's a reason why we're producing hybrids, because we want to reflect the glory of our flora in people's gardens. We want to provide habitat to local fauna. And so by producing hybrids, you get less of that drop dead. You can build plants that will live in people's gardens, but also look absolutely fantastic.
Okay, introduce me to the bunch of flowers you've got here. They always look great on radio, but yeah. They're wonderful colours, a variety of colours.
Right, so I've been breeding wax flower for about 25 years. So originally started in the cut flower side of things, because wax flower is Australia's number one export flower crop, and now grown around the world, in fact, for cut flowers. And so what we wanted to do first up was to increase the vase life. And so we've managed to take the vase life of wax flower from about 7 days to about 20 days. And that's by bringing other species, particularly into the Camelosium uncinatum, which is a Geraldton wax. That's the base for the breeding. And we use species like Camelosium megalopetalum, which provides that terminal flowering and that vase life. But with breeding, you need to get to the second generation, the F2 generation, to get all the changes that can be made through combining that those particular genes. And all Camelosium first generation hybrids are sterile. So one way of restoring fertility to sterile hybrids is to double the chromosomes, because that allows better pairing. But it also has the added advantage of producing plants with much larger flowers. And though it is radio, you can see here, Robin, that you know, I have one this size, a standard wax flower, and then when we double the chromosomes, the flower's twice to three times the size of it.
And the hearts in the middle go from yellow to purplish. Yeah. And is this called tetraploidy?
It is, yes. It's called ploidy, and these are tetraploids compared to diploids. So diploid, the di and the diploid, means two pairs of chromosomes.
You and me, we're diploid, aren't we?
Yeah, we are, yeah. I can tell
from looking at you.
Yeah, that's right. In animals and humans, that tends to be the stable state, because if you delete or add chromosomes, it's unsuccessful. But plants are different. They're quite amenable to having their ploidy change. So this scarlet flower plant here, the Verticordia grandis, is a natural tetraploid. And they estimate about 70 plants through the evolution of the species have gone through some level of ploidy change. So the thing about this Verticordia grandis is that we want to bring that scarlet colour into wax flower, because red flowers are the most popular flower colour on the planet. So if we can bring the red into the wax, then we can really increase the amount of flowers that we can export and look great in people's gardens. So we do have a hybrid now between the Camelosium and the Verticordia, and it's this one here. But interestingly, the colour pathway in both of these genera is the anthocyanin pathway. So when there's a enzyme called 3'5' hydroxylase present.
I'll write that down.
Yes, that's right. It produces these more purple and magenta coloured flowers. When it's absent, the pathway goes to the scarlet colour. However, when you do a hybrid, because it's present in part of the genome, it drives the colour to the purple magentas, which is not the colour we want. Mm. So that's why we need to go to the second generation. So then when you get recombination of the genetics, some of the plants that you then produce will have scarlet flowers. Yeah. So that's where we are. This one's an F1, so we're trying now to get that to the F2, the second generation, to get that scarlet flowered wax.
Indeed, you're sounding a bit like Gregor Mendel a long time ago, doing the breeding of peas way back and revolutionising everything. Darwin didn't know about him, but the F1 and the F2 was absolutely key to getting somewhere. But you mentioned anthocyanin before, I think, and isn't that the red rusty colour you get in autumn leaves?
Yes, it is. It's actually widely produced in plants. So red grapes, for instance, that's the colour that produces the red grapes. And they come in a range of various colours. They're actually a chemical in the plant that protects them from stress. So you'll often see plants that grow in cold conditions, for instance. If it's a bit of a frosty period, they'll produce those red leaves. So that's anthocyanin being produced in the plant that stops that burning of those young leaves. But also if you get an insect attack, you'll often see a little circle with a reddish colour around it. Again, that's the plant producing those anthocyanins. And plants being very efficient, they've adapted that anthocyanin pathway to produce colour in flowers.
And going back to those kangaroo paws, when you release them to the public, do you think they'll be immensely popular, and when can they get them?
Well, I'm actually really hoping they'll be immensely popular. Everyone I show the colours to are pretty well gobsmacked. You know, they're very excited. So the first plants are being sent to the wholesalers in about September, August, September this year. So it'll be a period of 2 to 3 months, I think, following that, that they'll make their way into retail nurseries.
Yeah, there have been various other blue flowers in the past. Have they done well?
Yeah, a lot of flowers are called blue and they're not blue. A lot of purple flowers, for instance, particularly in the US, they love to call purple flowers blue because it's the marketing thing. If people hear blue or see it's blue and think, I'll have that, that's fantastic. Here we've actually got real blue in a blue kangaroo paw. So, yeah, we're excited about how they're going to go, absolutely.
Talking about excitement, my final question, do you have fun here in the park?
Oh, look, every day I come here, I live a fortunate life, and part of my fortune is working in Kings Park and Botanic Garden, yeah.
Yes, they all seem to be having fun, don't they? Plant breeder Digby Grounds at Kings Park in Perth, with his blue kangaroo paw looking very pretty. I feel pretty.